netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. This week, this weekend, we're going to the SciTech Oscars in Hollywood. This is the science part of the arts and sciences that the Academy stands for, and we're very proud to be associated this year, as we have been in the past, with just bringing to your attention, I guess, some of the great work that's being honoured by the Academy, and it really is brilliant stuff. We're going to be at the SciTech Awards on Saturday, February 7th, but in this podcast, we thought we'd talk to just one team that's being honoured as part of this year's celebration. So we've got written articles over an FX Guide, and we've got, of course, more stuff coming. But for now, we're just going to look at one of the categories which is being recognized, which is the Kylie Destruction System. Now, this is actually part of the DMM, which stands for Digital Molecular Matter Toolkit, that was put together that is being recognized in the same category. And to just set the stage for you, James O'Brien is a researcher at Berkeley who's done some terrific work, very influential, done just a ton of contributions to the science and, I guess, craft of visual effects works. His work was published at SIDGRAPH, and Eric Parker and the team that Eric's with picked up on that and decided to look at this work. Now, we've covered it before in the art of we call it the art of blowing crap up. If you do a Google search on FX Guide and the art of blowing crap up, you'll find the destruction pipeline piece that I wrote, and it has three or four different approaches. Interestingly, one of those is FISBAM, which is also being recognized by the Academy. And in fact, we've spoken to the FISBAM team, and we'll be covering them in a written article from the Oscars. Anyway, to get back to the essence of DMM, this was picked up by Eric and his team as being a really interesting thing because it was based around finite element analysis. Now, finite element analysis, as you'll hear me say as I speak to the three recipients, kind of seemed really complicated and hard to do. It just didn't seem like the sort of thing that would happen anywhere near inside the perspective of film work. And yet, James O'Brien's stuff was clearly brilliant and really good, and Eric and the team set to making not just a version of this, but in fact a real-time gaming engine version of this. When Ben Cole at MPC was trying to look for a destruction pipeline for the work for MPC, he was stunned to see that Eric Parker and the team had published work built on James O'Brien's work that was in fact running in real time. He thought, well, if they can do that in real time, then maybe we're onto something here. So Ben Cole and the team at MPC have a destruction pipeline that is being used in a number of feature films, as you'll hear, really very, very effective, but somewhat... Well, it's very much built on DMM, but not an exact implementation around it. It's an extension. And so, in a sense, and Ben came up with this, it's a bit of a race, I guess, some kind of baton race that has passed from James to Eric to Ben. Now, that would be to imply that James and Eric are no longer doing anything, and that's not true. As you'll hear when I speak to James O'Brien, they're still very much researching the area and coming up with some terrific new algorithms in what's being done. Similarly, Eric Parker has developed up a lot of very good stuff, and the DMM has gone on to be a toolkit that can be implemented and used elsewhere. We're seeing generally finite element analysis stuff appearing in places like Houdini, which is terrific. And of course, MPC, as being one of the world's great visual effects houses, is using it extensively in an enormous number of films. And I think one of the great things about the Academy is how well it recognizes these combined efforts, and it does a tremendous amount of work. James actually brought this point up to me when we were talking. It was like, of all the awards that he's been up for and of all the sort of various citations and things that have happened with his research, he felt the Academy was one of the best processes for actually reviewing and working out the real nature of who contributed what to the process. So let's cross now to my interview with James O'Brien, and then I'll come back and we'll cut over to Eric and then finish up with Ben Cole. So firstly, congratulations on the acknowledgement from the Academy.
Well, thank you very much. It's very exciting.
Obviously, we're going to talk in a moment about the tremendous contribution you made and sort of the relay race of passing the baton that went between your initial work and then stuff that happened with DMM and then, of course, Kylie at MPC. But for those that don't know, you're at Berkeley, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm at UC Berkeley right now.
So you have done an enormous amount of graphics research and publishing. I was just wondering if you could give us a view on what you're currently doing. I know that you've been publishing, what, since 95, but a tremendous volume of contribution to the industry.
Well, yeah, thanks very much. That's very nice to say. So we've written a lot of different papers about a wide variety of different techniques, ranging from the finite element destruction modeling work that is what this award is recognizing, to cloth simulation, methods for determining if images are, this is not really related to the film industry, but methods for determining if images have been manipulated or edited. So imagine somebody Photoshops a picture of you with, somebody you don't want to be seen with, to discredit you if you're a politician or something.
What was the paper that you, it was your PhD, wasn't it, that in fact spurred the interest of the finite element analysis in use in destruction pipelines?
Right. So this was actually an idea I had when I was in grad school. And I'd always been fascinated by sort of breaking the way things crack and tear. I think a lot of people are. It's very interesting. And so I had the idea for putting together a simulation method that would be able to model these things, and that hadn't been done before. There had been a little bit of previous work using spring and mass systems that just didn't, if you looked at it, it looks sort of like little Lego blocks breaking apart. It didn't really capture the way things really behaved and tore when they would experience a fracture. And so I developed a finite element method that was able to model those, that kind of behavior. And that was, as you said, that was the topic of my PhD thesis. It actually won our university's award for outstanding thesis that year. And I wrote a paper, then a shorter condensed version of the thesis that was submitted to SIGGRAPH that year in 99. And that paper was accepted. And actually they had a impact paper or best paper award that year. And I guess not best, outstanding paper award. My paper was one of the ones, they selected three that year, and that was one of them. So that was really a very great start. I was very happy and excited about it. We did some follow-on work a couple years later where we looked at ductility, which is basically, if you think about when things break, if you think about a balloon shattering or breaking glass, the cracks go flying through it very quickly. When you break glass, you don't watch the crack slowly going through it. It just goes into it. Same with the balloon. Even though the balloon's a stretchy material, it's actually still brittle. On the other hand, if you look at a material like clay or aluminum foil, when you start tearing it, or pulling it apart, it tears, for example, instead of shattering. And what's happening is the material actually bends and yields plastically. So just the way if you think about foil, if you bend it, it stays bent.
Yep.
That sort of behavior is called plastic yielding. So basically bending, although it can happen on very, very small scales, and that changes how the cracks behave and look in ways that are very interesting. And so we developed a method that included that as well and wrote a follow-on paper, and I guess it was 2002 that included that.
But didn't your original paper in 99, that was with brittle fracture, wasn't it?
It was brittle,
yep.
And we extended it to then in 2002 include ductal fracture as
right.
well.
Right, because the plastic elasticity is one of the aspects of finite element analysis in that, you do get these strains and bending. And of course, this is not a hack. This is exactly what you'd expect mm-hmm. and what the engineers rely on.
Right. So there's a lot of hacks since I published the work, since the time then, a lot of other people have looked at this and some people are very nice. I've had people that wrote and told me that I've inspired their work, and that's very, that makes me feel very good. And they've built techniques that in some cases are a little bit faster, that use rigid body simulation combined with some sort of heuristic to break the material apart. And the result is that you can get stuff that does look, especially like Voronoi diagrams, you can get yep. stuff that kind of looks like it's breaking. at least it looks like sort of a material that sort of shatters apart into these kind of big chunks. And so you can see a lot of examples of papers. Actually, one of my students recently wrote a paper. He works at NVIDIA now, one of my past students, and Nutapong Chentanez, and he wrote a very nice paper that has some really nice looking results. All of these methods that use the rigid body combined with some sort of algorithm to algorithmically crack material based on some heuristic, they can look like things that are sort of shattering, but when you start looking at real materials, if you look at stone or if you look at brick and look at how it shatters and the types of pieces it makes, if you look at then in comparison glass, which breaks in another very, very different way than stone does, if you look at, for example, materials like steel, like a car made out of a body panel with its body panels and how they bend and tear during an accident, or if you think about a wooden structure and how it sort of bends and splinters and comes apart, these things all sort of have very unique and very interesting looks. And if you compare those to the rigid body methods, you see that there's a lot of richness and realism that the rigid body methods don't quite capture. Although the rigid body methods do tend to be faster. And so that's a trade-off that, you know, both methods have their merits. The fine element work we're doing, because it takes all this into account, including the plasticity and ductility that you just mentioned, we can do a fairly wide range of materials. And if you look at some of the examples that have been where we've used this in film, and if you look at some of the examples in our papers, you can see this. In fact, the paper we published just recently in SIGGRAPH 2014 has a really wide range of examples that show a lot of very different materials besides materials that just shatter into some very simple pieces. We you know, even if you're dealing with the brittle stuff, when you get it just right, if you look, we have a shattering glass example where you get that characteristic bullseye type pattern, that spider web pattern, where you've got the radial lines going out like concentric circles. And getting that right requires getting the physics not perfectly right, but very close to right. So we did this all from the research point of view in academia. And then at some point I was approached by Vic and Mitch. I think you know both of them.
Yeah. Actually, I wanted to step in there if I can for 1 second, because one of the things that's astounding, if you go to that 99 paper that was published in SIGGRAPH, and I think it's like about on the last page, you have a bunch of computational examples, which are good. Now, obviously Berkeley is one of the world's great universities, so you came at this with a lot of credibility. But nevertheless, the minutes of computation time per simulation in that 99 paper had things that were like averaging, 300 minutes or whatever.
And yeah, they took overnight.
And then now we have Eric and the guys walking in and saying, hey, this looks really good. Let's do that in real time. And I think you were doing stuff on an SGIO-2, which in its day wasn't a bad thing with its old 10K processor. And yet, at some point, did they say to you, yeah, we think we might do your stuff for games and real-time simulation, and you just look at them and say, are you guys mad?
No, not at all. See, here's the thing. My philosophy on doing research in this area has, and not just the fracture of the cloth as well, has always been the way to approach a problem is figure out how to do it right first, even if it's very, very slow, and then figure out how to make that fast. So the work that I did in 99, I was using an explicit integrator, the way you figure out how things move forward in time, that's the integrator. And the method I used was one that was very simple to implement, but it's very inefficient. And I didn't take any time to optimize the code. Basically, this was research code. My goal was to get things, working to get demonstrating results that demonstrated the idea.
Now, so you were aware when you were publishing,
definitely,
very much, that there would be great optimizations that would be possible. But of course, you were focused on the algorithmic implementation. Right.
I mean, if you're a grad student, you only have so many hours in a day to write code. And so you have to optimize your own effort.
Yeah, I mean, you're not trying to produce 100 shots. But nevertheless, it was certainly from an outsider such as myself, it was quite astounding to see finite element analysis, which I had put in the mental box of very good, very accurate, very slow. Awesome if you're trying to work out if the nuclear power plant's going to fall over, but not really good for computer graphics. And then suddenly these guys were appearing saying, oh, yeah, we've been working on this on real time in games. And I was like, I'm sorry, that must be a different finite element analysis than the one I learned about when I was at school.
Well, actually, if you want to be precise, finite element analysis is a family of mathematical techniques that is incredibly broad. It's sort of like saying, if you think about it, saying finite element analysis is like saying vehicle with wheels.
Yeah, okay. But right. Nevertheless, the converging... Okay, but the converging, notwithstanding that, right, I'm sure you're aware of the popular culture use of the finite element analysis in that sort of engineering sense. It was a tool that was of the quality that you would want if you were doing something that was engineering, but by no means was anyone sort of, I think, walking around thinking that this was an obvious real-time gaming solution.
Well, that was just what we thought. Vic and Mitch originally, when they approached me, they had a very different idea that they wanted help with, which was a voxel-based method for modeling geometry. And it was really just happy luck because, in a lot of ways, the serendipity. Because what happened was, you know, they came to me and they originally said, "Well, you know how to do computer graphics, and so we want your help with this." And what I told them was, "Well, actually, because what they were thinking about modeling the world as these sort of voxel-based objects, and then you could break those apart somehow." And I said, "Well, why don't we actually do real fracture simulation?" And you know, I believed very strongly that it could be made to work in real time, particularly if you go to lower resolution than what you would need to do screen type effects. And the other thing is, even from the very beginning, we basically felt that the right approach to this was to sort of develop something that would be as fast as possible. If that ends up being fast enough for games, wonderful. But even if it's not, we still have this whole film industry to target.
Sure.
And so basically we sort of looked at it as like this is something where we can try to shoot for a goal, which is real-time performance. If we don't make that goal, we still have film, which is very exciting. And if we make the real-time goal, that's going to make the film even more exciting because it'll let you be faster for the film, which means that you'll be able to do more detailed, bigger special effects. And so that's what we started working on. And there, a lot of the credit for making things work in real time really goes to Eric Parker. So Eric Parker was their sort of main technical guy at the company Pixelux. He had a lot of great experience coding very efficient code for video games on machines. I don't remember exactly which ones, but old Apple machines that, you know, were you know, my iPhone is like 1,000 times more computing power than one of those things had. More than 1,000, probably a million times more computing power than one of those things had. And, you know, they're basically calculators. And, you know, so that was the environment he was coming from, a very, 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 very strong efforts on optimizing. He wasn't familiar with FEM at that point. But one of the things teaching at Berkeley, one of the things that I'd learned to be pretty good at is, you know, saying this is something that somebody doesn't know yet, and I'm going to teach it to them. And he's a very smart guy. He learned this stuff quickly. And then from that point on, we were working together on basically building the system. And putting a lot of effort into making it fast. If you read the paper we published in 2009, it details all these crazy optimizations that Eric put in there to make the code as fast as possible. And in fairness, by the way, there are a lot of things that he did when we went to port that code onto game consoles. There were a lot of crazy things he did that were specific to the game consoles, which unfortunately, because of their weird NDA policies, you can't really talk about. But he really did an extraordinary effort there.
Yeah, so now, of course, Eric shares the award with you, as does Ben. Now, I know you've met Ben since, but when Ben was looking at the MPC solution, you weren't actually involved directly with Ben, were you? So it was like effectively Eric worked and learned from you and then passed the baton, as it were, to Ben.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly – I mean, you can also view it as like a game of telephone where Eric and Ben – would talk, and then Ben, and then Eric and I would talk, and with Eric sort of being the conduit in between. And then of course, you know, at some point I have been in touch with Ben. We've been and that's been great. But a lot of the stuff that, you know, so remember the Kali is built on top of DMM. So the simulation code that's in Kali is all the DMM code. It's been optimized now even further, particularly since MPC has a very nicely designed system that I think Ben's been largely, in large part, responsible. I don't know exactly about who's other than Ben, who's worked on building their computing infrastructure, but it's very impressive what they have. And so now the question was, well, let's make, you know, we had a version of DMM that was optimized for basically a single machine, a single core on a single machine, or using a few cores, but it wasn't as heavily optimized as what you need to do literally, you know, tens of millions of elements in the environment that MPC had built. And so that involved a lot of work, again, a lot of work which Eric did, and then also building a lot of tools to use DMM, which I believe is one of Ben's main contributions.
Let's talk about that linear scaling for a second, because Eric designed things so that it would allow for a fairly linear scale, and yet he didn't anticipate the kind of stuff that would be thrown at it by Ben and MPC. I mean, he hoped that would all work fine, but I mean, was it always in your mind that the solutions that you're working on would be able to scale well?
Well, there's nothing really that stops them from scaling. I mean, so there are a couple of different things about scaling. So one of them is, like, for example, does your algorithm scale like n squared or like n? So, you know, if you double the amount of elements, is it four times as much work or two times, or, or worse, eight times as much work? Who knows? And so from an algorithmic point of view, we knew what the answers to that were. It's not quite linear. It's actually a little bit slower than a little bit worse than linear. But that's something we were already aware of. And there's another kind of scaling, which is scaling to take advantage of multiple processors. And that's a very tricky thing to do. Taking an algorithm, making it use two processors is not, you know, two concurrent threads is not so hard, really. Making it use eight or four or eight is a little bit more difficult. Making it use 64 and using them efficiently so that they're not just sitting there idle all the time, that's very difficult. And so that's a big part of the effort. There's also other things that you have to start dealing with when you get to very large size working sets. That is, you look at the amount of data you're working on. It's not just, you know, a few kilobytes of a finite element mesh. It's now gigabytes of finite element mesh. How do you deal with the fact that that doesn't fit in your machine's cache anymore, and that you're basically, you know, moving a lot of memory around? If you're not careful, you end up in situations where the movement of data and memory is taking more time than the actual computation. That is, all your, in the worst case, you'd have a situation where basically all your CPUs are sitting there idle, you know, some significant percentage of the time while they're waiting on memory, stuff to be fetched out of memory and brought into the cache. That's, avoiding that and avoiding that when you get a lot of very large sized data sets, and when you have a lot of concurrent threads, avoiding that situation actually is very difficult.
So just jumping ahead to today, clearly you have a team at Berkeley still publishing in this area, though you publishing in a wide range of areas, as I said, but something like the adaptive tearing and cracking and that kind of stuff, how much is that something that, you know, is you still work with Pixelux and others over directly? How much is it that you are just today running concurrent and in parallel to them?
Well, so the DMM currently, there's not a new revision of that currently being developed. It's being used at MPC, but the core engine right now, we're not putting out a second version of that at the moment. One of the things I would like to do is to take some of the work that we have that's using newer methods and start developing commercial code that would use that. We've done this already, not the fracture stuff, I mean, but we've taken the code that does the cloth simulation, and we're working on basically trying to commercialize that right now. It's an adaptive mesh simulation code for doing cloth that we've named ArcSim. And we've actually made that publicly available and free for non-commercial use. I'd love to see that get picked up and widely used in the film industry for doing cloth simulation. I think it has a lot of very strong benefits. And also the paper that we just published in 2014, we have some new ways of doing fracture. And one of the things I'm going to be looking at is what we need to do to actually try to now take those ideas from the lab, from the university, and push those out towards commercializing them. And so one of the things I'm going to be talking with is, you know, talking with Vic and Eric and Mitch about what the next step should be for DMM. So we'll see what happens.
I mean, Berkeley isn't as focused as, say, an MIT on a commercialization kind of viewpoint, but clearly university research, you know, spills into, and it's a good partnership. I'm just wondering, like, are there other areas that you're just exploring that which are very much just pure research and have no kind of commercial application? It's a completely valid thing to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, I've published papers where, if you ask me what, like, so a while ago I did some work with actually an MIT professor, Eric Demain, on taking linkages in the plane and refolding them into different configurations. And I think if you were to ask me, I mean, I don't want to speak for Eric, but I think the work's very, very interesting from an academic point of view, but, and this is a different Eric, by the way, Eric Demain, but I don't want to speak for Eric Demain. But from my point of view, when I look at that work, I think academically it's very interesting, it's intellectually very exciting. But if you ask me what's the application for it, I'm going to sort of say, well, actually, I'm not really sure there is an application.
So now I thought that would have ruled, I'm joking, but I would have thought that would have ruled MIT out of doing any research that wasn't linked to
industry. No, I mean, I think people have their outside perceptions of universities. I mean, if you look a lot of, you know, for example, you know, you can look at universities and say, you know, they get a little bit stereotyped sometimes, but a lot of stuff's come out of Berkeley that's had huge commercial success. BSD, for example, is something that came out of UC Berkeley. And if you're using a Mac, you're using BSD right now. In fact, I think pretty much if you're using almost any computer, you're using something that has descended from BSD. I mean, if you're using Windows, the chain of descent's a little bit, a little bit obscure in most cases. But any Unix-based or Linux-based system, so that's one example. Risk is another one. And in fact, if you're using you've got a very nice setup that looks like a nice microphone and so on that I'm seeing there. So I'm guessing that your computer systems are backed up maybe in a RAID configuration to make sure that if one drive crashes, you don't lose all your data. That's another Berkeley invention as well.
I should say maybe I expressed myself wrongly. I actually think it's a terrific thing not to have commercial considerations, because I think we rely increasingly on universities to do pure research. And I feel having to hang a commercial handle on, you know, university research is an onerous thing to do. So don't get me wrong. My view is very much not the case that you should have to have a commercial focus.
Well, that's a really good point. And maybe it's always nice to sort of bring this point up. A lot of stuff, so industry is really great at taking something that's going to be profitable in 2 years, for example, and investing resources in development. Sometimes you can see 5-year horizons, but it's very rare that you see longer than that, because if you're trying to run a successful business, unless your business is already very successful and has a lot of basically surplus, it's hard to sustain that. Universities, on the other hand, I mean, if you think about this, the work that I published in 99 today is getting this award from the Academy. That's 15 years, 16 actually, right? So that's 16 years that it took for something to really reach this point. I don't think there are very many startup companies that could have lasted 16 years if we tried to develop it that way. So the idea that the universities I don't want to say pure research or, you know, pure academic research, but the idea is that they can do things that don't have immediate obvious payoffs, or where the payoff is not only immediate, as in it might be 15 years from now, but it's not even clear that there would be a payoff. You know, for every paper that's written in a university that, you know, 15 years from now has some kind of important contribution, there's going to be 20 or who knows how many that don't make it. If we didn't have that, if we weren't able to do that, then we'd all still be sitting around, you know, banging on stones or something.
Yeah, and you don't have many organizations that are willing to do research that is without a corporate direction, whereas university research should be allowed to explore whatever is exploring. And that takes you to places you didn't expect to be at. I think it's incredibly important. Okay, well, again, thank you so much, and I will see you in LA.
All right, thanks a lot. Have a good evening.
Well, I want to thank James for his time. And as I said at the outset, we're now going to talk to Eric Parker and his role in developing DMM. And I must admit, I was always curious what DMM actually stood for. Why those three letters? Why that name?
Well, the name came about, I recall when it happened. I was in my backyard laying on my kid's trampoline at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And Mitch and Vic and I were on a conference call. I was staring at the stars. And I don't know, we were just throwing out random names here and there. And I'm not sure. I think it was a combination of Mitch and I came up with that product name. But we came up with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, I think...
I remember doing that on that trampoline, just laying there looking at those stars.
Right. I assume it was a fairly balmy evening then.
Yeah, it was. It was a nice evening here in Dallas. That's where I live.
Oh, excellent.
The project's been in, was really started back in, 2002 or somewhere in that range, 2003, somewhere around then, was really the beginning of this project. So it has been ongoing for a long time.
So can I discuss that early day stuff? I know from Vic and doing stuff on you guys earlier for FX Guide about the fact that there was stuff at ILM, but could you talk about when you first connected with James O'Brien or had you known him for years? Because it was his sort of PhD thesis that fed into a lot of the thinking that you were working on. Was that not right?
Yes, that's right. So... Pixelux was founded around 2000 or 2001, something like that. And, we were thinking about technologies for potentially computer games as well as, movie production or commercials, video editing, that kind of stuff. And I was always big into simulation. I had created a series of flight simulators back in the 90s. And then I also did some work on MIMS design tools for MIMS. And in fact, interestingly, also getting an award on February 7th is the guy who created the DLP micromirror array, the Texas Instruments micromirror array. And that device was something that kind of motivated me to work on my MIMS tools. It was basically a voxel based solids modeling kernel that allows you to take the photo masks and simulate the deposition and etch operations for producing three dimensional structures on integrated circuits. And MIMS uses that same technology. So anyway, that's interesting. I'll actually want to kind of meet him because I've never met him before. But that's just an aside. But anyway, I've always been interested in simulation. And so started playing around with doing some finite element stuff. And I had read James' paper from, I think it was 1999, he published a SIGGRAPH paper. I wasn't actually familiar with directly with his PhD thesis until I read the SIGGRAPH paper.
Right.
And... I'd had some familiarity with finite elements from my MIMS work and just started kind of playing around with it and built a little prototype of that and made some animations using that prototype. One was of a castle being bombarded by boulders. And apparently, through some kind of crazy set of references, something to do with the Burning Man thing out in the California desert, someone mentioned that we had this destruction capability to someone at either ILM or at LucasArts. And then they requested that video got sent out, and I guess someone showed it to George Lucas, and he got excited or wanted us to, get in contact with us. So that's, I really don't know all the details of how that may have come about, but something to do with that video being seen of that original sort of castle destruction. So that was all just prototype code that I had created. It wasn't really production ready at that point, but it did demonstrate the capability. And when we got sort of in discussions with Lucasfilm, then... Vic he knew that I was using James' technique for computing the destruction, and So he actually just called up James and asked him to come out to visit with us. So that's how that, you know, collaborative effort got underway. So I spent some time working with him, kind of continuing to develop that piece of code based upon, you know, discussions that we had back and forth. And it's just over the years, we probably met at least a dozen times and had discussions on, James and I, on various, you know, various things that went into producing DMM.
Yeah, because so, Ben was saying that while he has now, of course, met James, he didn't know James at all when he was starting to do work with MPC's pipe, but of course worked with you.
Right, that's right. So basically, the DMM library, you know, was worked on and honed over a period of, really, there was probably 4 years of just really intense effort that went into it. But like I said, the project goes back to like about 2002 or 2003. But it became, you know, a very stable and very high-performant library. That was really a big goal for me. An overarching goal was try to reach what I would call linear scalability, so that if you double the size of the problem, then you only double the amount of time it takes to compute it, as well as to provide parallelism. Yeah.
Well, of course, with collision detection, that shouldn't be the case, right? You should double the number of objects.
Well, so the way I look at it for collision detection is it's output sensitive. So if you've got 100 objects, but all 100 objects are co-located, then you're obviously going to have 10,000 collisions. So I look at it as that is my in. So however many collisions or contacts you're generating, then, and however big the size of the meshes are, the number of elements, then I want it to have linear scaling with respect to those numbers. Obviously, it can't be with respect to just the number of objects, because you can create n squared collisions. but you generally don't have every single object in the whole universe co-located. So that would be considered a mistake.
Yes.
but yeah, so a big focus of mine was to try to use lazy evaluation and, you know, try to state changes, because obviously state changes are a huge part of destruction. I mean, things are changing state all the time. They're changing from this nicely modeled, you know, low number of element count thing to arbitrary amounts of destruction with contact and things inside others and things that were on the inside on the outside. And, you know, the configuration and state changes are immense. So that was a big focus, was how to minimize the costs associated with those, you know, reconstructing and rebuilding everything and trying to minimize the, basically try to do everything differentially. And whenever things change state, to avoid recomputing stuff until absolutely necessary and try to cache as much information as possible and utilize information from previous frames, you know, frame-to-frame coherence. So there was a lot of that kind of work that went on for those 4 or 5 years, where we really had major efforts going into the product. So at the end of all of that, we basically had a functioning toolkit, and we published a paper, James and I did, that was published, it actually won best paper at the SCA, the Symposium for Computer Animation, which is sort of a side conference that's part of as a part of SIGGRAPH. It's not part of the main conference of SIGGRAPH, but it's specifically about animation, you know, doing animation generally through physical simulation. It seems to be what most of the papers there concentrate on. Anyway, we presented there, and then Ben saw that paper, and I guess at that time he was looking for some kind of a solution to destruction. And I think the paper really helped to convince him, you know, to give him confidence to attempt to utilize DMM, because, you know, these things are kind of like big black boxes and no one really knows how well implemented they are or whether they could handle, you know, large scale problems and be robust. So I think the paper helped a lot with helping to convince Ben that he should take a look at it. But,
yeah, I mean, his comment was, if they can do it in real time, then I stand a good chance of being able to do it non-real time for film.
Right, exactly. And that focus on scalability, I think, was a key to NPC's ability to be incorporated, because obviously they're throwing huge numbers of elements at the thing. And there was some work that still needed to be done. I mean, we had never run simulations of the scale that they were doing, so it's kind of theoretical that it would scale to that. And there were a few hiccups along the way. But there were things like, you know, my collision table, my hash table for contact pairs, I just stored sort of object IDs as a 16-bit value, so you would never have more than 65,000 objects. Well, that obviously was an issue. So there were some places like that, you know, where the concept was good, the data structure was good, and it scaled nicely, but it just had some limitations. We also had to go to obviously a 64-bit memory space, pointer space. ILP64 or LP64, and you know, port it over to Linux and do some of those other kinds of things just to make it viable for MPC.
What was it running on when they saw it? It wasn't running on Linux.
Say again?
It wasn't running on Linux when they saw it?
I think we did actually have a Linux version at that time, because we were supporting, we already had the Maya plugin as a product, and we did have a Linux version of that as well. So, yeah, I think the Linux version was working at that time.
So the next thing is the DMM isn't exactly what obviously MPC implemented, in the sense they use some of the library stuff very much as is, but there are other aspects of it that are kind of different. So, for example, as I understand it, their TETMesh gets stretched in ways that your DMM normally doesn't, for things like their approach to fracturing of wood and stuff. Is that correct?
Well, we did do some things with very, very long, skinny elements for doing wood. But, you know, the tools that we had that went into the Maya plugin, those are not, you know, people are not achieving, you know, X-Men with that. So there's no doubt that MPC did a huge amount of work on their side to take this basically engine, it's sort of a solver engine,
yep,
that's scalable, which is what DMM is, and then, you know, fit that into their pipeline. And they, you know, Ben and those guys did a lot of innovation on their side to, which they understood their problem. So we didn't, that's the kind of the neat thing about this collaboration, because, you know, I'm not in the film industry myself, and I don't understand all of the pipeline and production issues and, you know, the art issues of what, you know, Ben and company do.
Yeah.
And, you know, James obviously is a researcher and publishes stuff, but he's not, you know, producing libraries. And I have all of this focus on performance and, you know, scalability and simulation. And I think each of us brought a huge amount of, you know, strength to this collaboration that each of us on our own, you know, wouldn't have been able to accomplish. And I think even if we were in a single company, it'd have to be a pretty big organization, I think, to be able to bring that kind of level of combination of experiences and viewpoints together. So I'm really happy about how it kind of worked out. And I certainly think that, you know, any one of us by themselves probably wouldn't have gotten this award. I think it had to really be a combination of the strengths of all of us to do that. But I know that NPC did a lot. And, it, you know, Ben obviously realized from, you know, from early on some of the advantages of this tetrahedral mesh representation separate from the geometry mesh and what that meant from their production standpoint. So Ben realized a huge value to the separation of the simulation mesh, which is the tetrahedral mesh,
yep,
from the embedded surface geometry mesh, which is the art mesh. You know,
yes,
those can be completely different resolutions, and they don't even have to be the same shape. You just have to be able to embed the surface geometry within the tetrahedral simulation mesh. And he realized, as soon as he saw that, a huge potential pipeline benefit to that separation, and being able to have the art group continue ahead, making changes to the art, making final art, while the simulation is running separately without any dependency. So it breaks that dependency, and that, to him, was a huge benefit.
That allows him to do the render time chopping, right? That swaps in geometry.
Exactly. Render time chopping, exactly. So they only bring the two things back together, you know, at render time, at the tail end of the thing. So they just have to kind of rough out an initial tetrahedral mesh, and that sort of sets the limits on where art can go. It can go somewhere inside that mesh, but it doesn't have to be precise. It doesn't have to be high resolution. It just has to be a roughed-in version. And then the physics team can go off separately and make progress while the art team makes progress. And then they two of them come back together at that chop time. So that, you know, he realized a huge benefit from that. And that wasn't something that either James nor I would have predicted, you know, not having the experience in that area. So, and then of course they've done a lot on their tool side. I'm not even familiar with, you know, their entire tool chain. So it's really interesting that each of us was able to make something that really the whole thing put together is sort of like greater than the sum of its parts, you know, and no one really understands the whole thing completely. We each know a little, our own little domain.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was wondering now if I could, just as a part of this, look at other companies other than MPC, just as a kind of a, today, because, you know, we covered stuff pretty extensively around 2011. And at that time, I asked the question, you know, why aren't more companies using finite element analysis? Because it seems to me to be such a kind of an elegant solution. And there was a number of reasons for that, but one of them came down to just the momentum of pipelines. But I was just wondering if you could talk today about the sort of reaction to a finite element approach. And then specifically, you know, any examples of where DMM is being used, not to take anything away from MPC, because we're obviously covering them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it has been getting some uptake in the games industry, at least for like pre-rendering. So there's a game coming out for the Xbox pretty soon called Quantum Break. And they did, the idea there is sort of a bullet time type thing where, you know, animation is paused. But the animation that's paused would be like some big bridge blowing up. And so it's right in the middle of the explosion, and it will run forward or backwards in time, and you can run around, you know, over all the beams while they're in the middle of breaking and the splinters flying and all of that. They're doing all of that simulation destruction using the Maya plugin offline, and then playing back those animations in-game. So there, you know, that's one interesting sort of application of it. But, you know, as far as finite element methods itself, you know, if you look at the literature, it's filled, you know, with finite element method. I mean, just about anything is almost deemed finite element. I mean, all it has to do is be a model of continuum mechanics and somehow converge. As you increase the resolution of your mesh, it should converge to a single solution. Then it's finite elements. If it doesn't do that, if it is using ad hoc techniques that don't have this convergence behavior, then it's really not finite elements. And you can use different kinds of finite elements. Some will have linear convergence, some will have quadratic convergence, but there has to be a fundamental underlying mathematical model that you're discretizing, and that's why it converges. And that's what finite elements is. So, you know, if you don't have that, if you don't have the convergence to a well-defined target, then you're working in a world of ad hocness. And, you know, it's sort of like I'll tweak it until it kind of looks good, and then I'll just move on to the next problem. You can do that. But I think that you gain a lot in terms of repeatability and predictability and controllability if you can do things like change mesh resolution and still get more or less the same behavior. You just get a higher resolution version of it. So I think there's a lot of benefits from finite element method, the finite element approach. And if you look at the graphics literature, it's filled with finite element methods. It's been utilized, although there's a lot of non-fine element or ad hoc approaches as well. A lot of position-based things are very popular. But I think that you don't see too many products utilizing it other than outside of the graphics community. You know, obviously civil engineering, you know, it's, they've been using it for 70 years. But
let's just reflect on that for a second, because up until you guys came along, certainly I was aware, you know, engineering applications, especially its ability to model what we, you know, like structural plastic elastic deformations and stuff, all great. Incredibly computationally expensive, just not realistic. And then suddenly you guys seem to come out of nowhere with, no problem, and we'll do it in real time. It's like, what?
Well, you know, I think James' paper kind of scared some people away too, because in his original fracture paper, he had run times that were, you know, like, you know, 60 days or something. It was just, I don't know if it was actually that, but it was 10 days of run time or something on one of the simulations. And I think finite elements definitely has this this sort of, for good or bad, it's sort of this, you know, kind of expectation that it's massively costly. But it actually is just a mathematical technique. And once you realize that and write, you know, starting from base, you know, first principles and say, well, what is actually what is a finite element approach? And what does it mean in terms of actual operations? You know, you do have some matrix operations going on, but, you know, it's not that big a deal, really. I think it just took playing with it, you know, just try it out, just see what's going on. And, you know, I can understand where, you know, these things that like ANSYS or these commercial packages, a lot of those things were written back in the Fortran and punch card era, you know, and they do things, they do things in order to like spool it to tape, you know, and that code really hasn't changed. They are still spooling it to virtual tape and they're reading it back out and doing all kinds of things that you wouldn't do if you knew you just had a 64-bit address space and 4 gigs of RAM, you know, to start with. And I think just the mere fact that, you know, I didn't really let that scare me away. I was just enthusiastic about the results I was seeing. You know, I read James' paper and I was really enthusiastic about those results, and I kind of dismissed his run times and said, well, let me just try it myself. So that is something that I guess has served me well over the years. I've always been reading SIGGRAPH papers and always just implementing them. And I've got lots of papers that I've implemented just as little prototypes. And you learn a huge amount by doing that, let me tell you. I mean, you can read the paper and it's like, oh, that sounds good. That sounds real reasonable. But then you go to try to implement it and you realize that there's all kinds of issues that the implementers kind of either dusted under the rug or just, or they weren't aware of something that really makes it a lot better. Something else, some other paper that it could be combined with. So I think that, I was just not scared of it.
my father literally used to say to me, you can read the entire works of Sigmund Freud, but sooner or later you've got to take a girl on a date.
Exactly. So I think it was just that practical focus and sort of, you know, I just like, I really have to get my head around something and actually implement it myself to really internalize it. But once I internalize it, I can throw away all the cruft and say, what is the, you know, the crystal at the middle of the thing, the gem, and then how do you do that? And how do you do that efficiently? So it was really just taking all the, you know, I did all these flight simulator games, and I did all this stuff for the MEMS work and, you know, nanotechnology and image processing. And, I mean, I just had a huge range of experience in many different fields.
So, Eric, this begs the question. This begs the question. I would be shot if I didn't ask. What are you playing with right now?
Well, right now I'm working on medical simulation. So I'm working on a company in Denver doing simulators to train doctors for endovascular surgery. So I've built a finite element system. This one is, high accuracy, but it simulates the catheters and wires that are used to place stents in the heart and do those kinds of things. So another interesting challenge. Learned a lot on this, a lot about constrained finite elements. So it's finite elements, but with added constraints. So that, for instance, you've got a wire inside of a catheter, that wire has to, say, co-located with the catheter. You don't want it to be, you know, going outside the catheter because it can't do that. So that means you have to add constraints to the system. You can do it all with little, like springs, little forces, but then that gets numerically unstable. So if you do it with constraints, then you're able to retain stability. And so, again, you just analyze a problem, pick the right set of techniques that will, you know, work well, then implement the whole thing. But that's been a fun project. It actually got me kind of thinking about how I could bring those back into DMM or into something for the movies or games industry, because I think there would be some applicability of some of the things I've been learning off of this project in that area. So who knows what the future will hold.
Well, now, finally, to cross to London and to Ben Cole. And I really have always enjoyed talking to Ben. He's a great guy. And we've been covering this for a long time because it's just such a remarkable implementation. And I'm joined now on the line by Ben. Hi, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, pretty well.
And congratulations on the award.
Yeah, no, thanks. And I think we felt we were doing something quite different at the time. I mean, we've spoken in the past about it, and I think it was necessary for us to do some of this stuff because we had challenges that were just not going to be met with the conventional techniques. And, you know, FEM just seemed like the right way to go. It's just such a versatile way of working.
So let's do a bit of a recap for the people that aren't as familiar, though I would seriously recommend our 2011 article on the art of destruction and blowing stuff up, because we went into it in some depth in that. But for people that don't know fully, you guys, I think, witnessed the 2009 SIDGRAPH paper on real-time stuff that was put out by the Pixel Art guys and said, hey, that kind of looks interesting. Is that how I recall it correctly?
Yeah, it's similar to that. I mean, we knew that we had this challenge. And, you know, it's like these sort of synchronicities that happen where you're wanting to solve a problem and you know what space you want to be in, and then something appears and you go, you know what? This works. This fits with what we're trying to do. And that paper arrived just at the right time.
Yeah, it really was really interesting to imagine that that was actually coming from the real-time world, because, you know, the thing that I always thought about finite element analysis, which is, of course, the basis of the technology that went into what you do today, is that it was just, you know, really, really computationally hard and too expensive to use. And the thought that it would appear from a real-time perspective was sort of definitely caught me unawares.
Yeah, it you know, that was part of it, right? It's like, oh, wow, well, if people can actually crank it up and do something that's compelling in real time, we should be able to take this and crank it up a whole lot more and, you know, get it to work for us for visual effects quality stuff.
Yeah, so the original research or the original stuff that the DMM stuff is based on, which is the Pixel-like stuff, is from the PhD, I guess, that James O'Brien did at Berkeley. Did he ever work with you guys directly? What was the relationship between that work, which then sort of went into LucasArts Entertainment and came out the other side? I mean, how did you work with them at all directly? Did they come over? How did it work?
We actually didn't work directly with James early on. We worked very closely with Eric and the guys at Pixelux,
right?
Who built the stuff. So, you know, it's a sort of long-standing sort of historical perspective thing, right? Where there was some original research done and implementation, and those guys worked closely, and then we picked up with that implementation and we worked closely. So it's a sort of you know, like a relay race in a way. You know, obviously, subsequently, we've spent some time with James and spoken with him quite a lot, and we've all become very, very familiar.
And Eric, I mean, when you're working with DMM, were you working with Eric Parker then?
Yeah, we worked together because we needed to sort of get some changes made and sort of push the technology really hard when we were really trying to push it to these high-end VFX things. I mean, the Pixelux guys had also built the tool and they had VFX in mind when they were building it. And the real-time application had sort of come up because that seemed to be the place, I guess, where they were getting traction.
Yeah.
Awesome. And so, but I don't think that they had necessarily really understood at the time just how hard we would want to hit this software, how many millions of tets we'd want to throw around and how complicated the simulations were going to get. So we worked with them to sort of, you know, push it really hard.
Okay, so Eric develops based on James's PhD, the digital molecular, digital molecular matter toolkit, which I'm just going to call DMM because it's less of a tongue tie. And you don't actually implement that exactly, do you? You implement kind of like a version that is, you know, sympathetic, but not actually a fully encased version of DMM. Because I'm thinking when you started with Sucker Punch, for example, you and I spoke about the fact that the splintering of wood was a sort of a slightly different approach to what they'd taken.
So the Pixelux guys have a number of different technologies, but underlying it, they have an API. And we took that API and we worked with it and we encased it in our own technology and started building Kali, which is a production tool. You know, it takes some of these core technologies. It wasn't that we necessarily changed the underlying engine, but we worked with them to sort of push it to make sure that it was capable of working at such large scales and looked at some of the ways that collisions were working and things. But we also added a whole bunch to the outside. You know, we had this idea that destruction pipelines were quite labor intensive and that they tended to have lots of feedback loops in them. And part of what I had been hoping to achieve for quite some time was an effects pipeline which sort of, you know, removed some of the feedback loops and created maybe a more nonlinear way of working, where maybe your asset team and your effects team and your lighting team didn't get caught up in a whole bunch of sort of iterations. And so the use of FEM and the idea that it had it gave you a sort of natural cage, was quite a compelling one to sort of add some of that that capability, because you could start working with your simulations completely independently of your renderable geometry. And, you know, in visual effects, unlike, for instance, in games, your shots have a particular length to them, which means there's a last scene and a last frame. And the last frame represents the place where the greatest level of destruction has occurred. So it allows you to sort of concentrate all of your effort in chopping up your geometry, for instance, on that. And those little things sort of helped us to really streamline the process. I think also with Kali, we really were interested in art directability, right? So, I mean, simulation is fantastic, and the ability to bend things and break things and flex and all of those cool FEM expressivenesses, those degrees of freedom are fantastic, but, you know, you have to put it into an artist's hands in a way that they can actually manipulate it and control it. And so a lot of what we've done with Kali has also been about allowing people to build custom events to sort of control behavior and to be able to reuse those things and to be able to connect things together in interesting ways and sort of have a toolbox that gives them a lot of expressivity.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things you've touched on there. I mean, one of them is that idea that you can naturally bend and stress things because you are, by basing it on finite element analysis, kind of looking at the stresses and the things before things break. So that isn't a hack. That kind of comes with it. But then there's also that whole idea of being able to get the sort of complexity that you want and art direct it, because at the end of the day, you can quite happily produce something that maybe isn't mathematically correct or fits with a finite element analysis model that would be good for engineering, but if it looks good on screen, it's going to be good to go.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. The visual effects is about making things that look compelling and convincing, but aren't necessarily 100% accurate. It tends to be the case that having an accurate physics model is more likely to give you a better looking physical effect, but you need to be able to manipulate it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you were setting up an actual blast on a wall, you'd want it to go in such a way that works for the camera angle, and it wouldn't matter that it's a real blast if it just completely covers the camera or doesn't do what the director wants. You know, the fact that it was done physically correctly in the room, in the studio, makes no difference to anyone, right? Similarly, I guess, with your simulations.
No, we have examples of situations like that where people have actually done practical effects and then come in and said, can you fix this?
So the other thing that is really interesting with the whole approach of having TETs and the way that that happens is the notion of how you do collision detection. So, you know, traditionally collision detection things are things like a bounding box or maybe level set stuff, but you actually get pretty good straight TET collision detection, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. And effectively, it gives you some control over how close you want that to approximate the renderable geometry, you know, because sometimes you might not want to use the full budget on accurate collisions. You might just want to have placeholder objects that you can, you know, that are cheaper in a way. But other times you might want to get right in there and have all of those details modeled in. And so you have that flexibility.
Right. Yeah, and that whole thing I think we discussed back in the day, that render time chopping and stuff to swap geometry is part of that sort of production pipeline mentality that MPC have had to employ.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what that gives you is the ability to do a few things. It lets you swap the model that you're using and keep working on the model even after the effects work has been done. You know, in your traditional rigid body pipeline, at least the old school rigid body pipeline, it would be the case that someone would give you a model. Your effects artist would spend time sort of chopping it up and doing things with it. They'd do their cool looking effects, and then someone would want an artistic change to the model, and the whole thing would have to start again. And if somebody liked a particular look of something, it would be very difficult to reproduce that. You know, this system makes it far easier. The other thing that you get with this render time chopping is you get the ability to do continuity, where you can build up pieces of destruction and actually layer them on to a single model. So you could have, you know, a destruction of a wall and then another destruction of a wall and then another, and you can sort of see that continuity building up over time. So it's a really flexible approach.
So since we last spoke in detail in 2011, I'm wondering, has it developed and changed much? I mean, remember then we were talking about that being a fixed number of TETs per setup, and obviously the TET mesh isn't identical to the object geos we've established, but there was some thought of having to have your TETs sort of distributed well or used well, as it was a fixed number and wouldn't dynamically change. Has the code developed much in the last few years?
We are still using a fixed number of TETs, but we have pushed our modeling tools quite a lot and worked on sort of post-simulation procedural detail and things like this to try and sort of maximize really what can be done and you know, improve the look as much as possible. So there's been quite a lot of effort in that. I mean, and also in the meantime, people have just continued to push the tool further and further and further, you know, larger scale simulations. And because of this sort of custom event system, we've also sort of grown a library of ways of doing things and of sort of new ways to connect things together and improve the efficiency of creating these simulations.
When we spoke back then, the two big examples of the great work you guys had done, I guess, was the original Sucker Punch and then X-Men. What are some more recent examples of some of the great work that has pushed it?
Godzilla would be a good example. I think we've really sort of pushed some of that building work and on that movie with the monsters sort of fighting and colliding with the buildings and everything. There's just a lot of detail there. Man of Steel is another example of, you know, the Smallville battle destruction where it really came out. But actually, the tool has become really a workhorse for us. I think we've used it on something like 30 movies or more. And for things that aren't just straightforward destruction either, we used it on Jack the Giant Slayer for the beanstalk effects, where you actually have a sort of organic sort of beanstalk that's being put under amazing amounts of tension by sort of wires, and it eventually sort of twists and then snaps and explodes. And that's pretty cool. And I've seen it being used for sort of other organic style effects as well that are really quite compelling, where you're actually getting a lot of that that bend and flex and that high tension stuff along with just the sort of fracturing.
Yeah, because I mean the plastic deformations, which is, I presume, that the basis of the sort of structural creep that you're talking about, really you get those pretty much for free. You don't have to do cheats, do you?
There's no cheating.
Yeah,
that's physics.
So you mentioned earlier some post-detail work that you're doing. Can you tell us more about that?
So that's about sort of going in and afterwards and finding the fracture surfaces that you've created in your tech meshes and sort of refining it and improving on the look of those edges. And also complementing that with some modeling tools that allow you to sort of selectively add detail, not just on the outside, but also on the inside of your destruction. Because effectively what you've got going on is an almost volumetric destruction toolkit, right? So you can work anywhere in your 3D space. And with the refinement stuff, it's really about sort of allowing yourself to subdivide or reconstruct a surface in order to remove perhaps some of the artifacts that you get from using a tetrahedralization of that space.
Yeah, that sounds pretty interesting, actually. And is that been something that's been used widely, or is that something that's more coming online now?
It's definitely been used. And I think it's one of the things that sort of increases the use cases for the tool, or at least, you know, makes it increasingly the tool to go to.
Yeah. So when I published that article in 2011, I actually asked the question rhetorically in the story, why more people weren't going down a finite element analysis path. And I'm going to ask you that question again. Do you feel like the idea of approaching destruction pipelines with finite element analysis has gained momentum in the last sort of few years since we spoke about this? Or do you feel like it's still working really well for you, but it seems like other people's pipelines are kind of fixed?
I think that people have started to adopt it. And I think part of the reason that we've been honored with this award is because that adoption is starting to happen. The guys at Houdini have started putting FEM in as an option. Some of the other major studios have been working with FEM and bringing it into their pipelines. So I think actually we've proven it. And people have seen the kind of quality of results that you can get, and a lot of people have started to pick up on it.
I mean, let's face it, MPCs are a very large player in the global scheme of things, so if only you used it, it would still be a really good body of work that was being used on it. But it does seem to me to be a very good... The mathematical purity of it, or the sort of the elegance of the implementation at the sort of conceptual level, really appeals to me. And I do like when you can provide an artist with a physically accurate tool that can be art directed. Like, I think that really gives somebody the reality that they want, and then the ability to deliver the shot. And you guys certainly seem to have done a marvelous job with this godless daughter of destruction from Hindi mythology that is Kali.
Well, yeah, thank you. I mean, it's definitely been a lot of fun putting it together and seeing the things that these effects artists, who deserve a lot of kudos, you know, are capable of doing with the tool.
Well, thank you so much, Ben, for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
And thank you.
Well, that's it for our FX podcast for this week. As I said, lots of other stuff happening over the SciTech winners as we applaud them, and also the winners this week at the VES Awards. There's been some great stuff, some really good simulation work honored. In fact, there was the Quicksilver sequence from X-Men that won Best Simulation Award. And there's more Simulation Award being honoured at Saturday night at the SciTechs. As I said, a written piece. We're going to go and look at ILM at the Oscars and talk to the ILM team, who won not only in the FISBAM category, but were also recognised for their work in their posing, or rather sculpting system. And we'll cover all of that coming up, as well as other written stories on SciTech winners such as UCAP and MOVA. Well, that's it for this week here at the FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. I'll be Twittering live from the SciTechs on the weekend. So if you want to follow me, I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter. Thanks so much to Jim and the team that edited all this together. And, of course, congratulations to all the people honoured by the scientific awards at the SciTechs.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.